From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Famous authors get fan mail. Even J.D. Salinger, who works hard at being a recluse. Letters arrive by the bushel.
I was sort of fascinated that all these people had written letters to him, but nobody had read them, except for the person who wrote the letter, because rumor had it that Salinger or his agent would, you know, regularly go to his mailbox and, like, take these all and put them in a bag and, like, have a bonfire.
After he published his most famous book, The Catcher in the Rye, J.D. Salinger withdrew from public life into the woods of New Hampshire. But 50 years later, Salinger's influence is still shaping culture, from film to high-profile crime.
He was picked up by the police after he sat down and was paging through The Catcher in the Rye. He shot Lennon, sat down, and waited for the police to come.
Today, the legacy of J.D. Salinger and The Catcher in the Rye, and the passing of the torch. Writer Charles Baxter shares a haunting story of teen angst, and Garrison Keillor writes about coming of age in small-town America. There's nothing harder to resist than a mystery. And for decades, J.D. Salinger has been just that. Every year, carloads of Salinger devotees head out to the woods of New Hampshire to see if, just maybe, Salinger will break his years of silence and talk to them. Chris Kubica has taken another route. He's given dozens of writers the chance to sound off on Salinger, to Salinger, in the form of a letter. The result is the book Letters to J.D. Salinger. Kubica told Steve Paulson he was blown away the first time he read The Catcher in the Rye.
I actually was given the book by my creative writing teacher in, 10th grade. And he said, you got to read this book. This is a really important book. And I didn't. I actually put it off for 6 months because somebody had told me what the plot of Grapes of Wrath was. And for some reason, I kept mixing up the plot of Grapes of Wrath with the title of Catcher in the Rye because of the word rye. And I was like, I don't want to read a book about a bunch of farmers in the 20s. That doesn't sound very exciting or relevant to my life. So I put it off for like 6 months. And then I finally first read it. I remember it vividly. I read it all in one sitting at home, and I had a waterbed, and I would read it, and I was laughing out loud, and I was sort of rolling and bouncing around in this sea in my room, and it was just an eye-opening experience.
Well, the appeal of The Catcher in the Rye has lasted to this day. I mean, how much of it was rooted in its time when it was written, and do young people still gravitate to it? And then the other question is, what happens if you're older? And if you're in your 40s or 50s or even in your 70s, does that book still work?
Catcher in the Rye is one of these really unique gems, I think. It actually, I think, grows with you as you grow older. As I've talked to people who have read the book, you know, so there's books like, you know, Huck Finn. And if you go back to Huck Finn when you're 6, when you're 12, when you're 80, you're always going to be a 12-year-old boy floating down the river with Jim. But with The Catcher in the Rye, you read it at 16 and you're Holden Caulfield and you're living that life and you are identifying with everything that he's doing. It wasn't even until I read the book again in college personally that it even registered for me that the whole book is being told from like a hospital bed in a sanatorium. You know, I didn't even realize that because that's not, you know, what I was focusing on. But when you read it later on, like when I read it in college, you start to see the cracks in this guy's veneer. He's got some problems. And you're not really sure if he's making the right decisions in a lot of ways. And then when you're even older, I think as like a person who would be a parent to somebody like this, and you read it and you're like, God, where were his parents? Who was intervening? This guy needs intervention. He's got communication problems. He doesn't understand boundaries. He's depressed.
So after Catcher in the Rye, Salinger just kind of disappeared off the radar. But my sense is that your book is not really for J.D. Salinger. It's for the readers left behind. And for you, these are kind of your love letters to Salinger.
They kind of are. People ask me a lot, you know, do you expect J.D. Salinger to write back? Or do you, you know, did you send him a copy of the book? And what do you think he's going to say? Or do you think he's read it? Or these kind of things. And all along, I've always seen this book as a response to his, quote, letters. So he's written a very influential novel, a whole bunch of short stories that we like. In fact, correspondence actually plays a really large role in his writing. If you look at almost every short story or book, somebody's writing to somebody. So he's written all these books and he's given them to us and he's sort of checked out from society and he doesn't want to talk to us. But that's okay. We still have a lot of stuff to say. So I sort of see this book as a response to his work, and now maybe sort of the equilibrium is back in check, so that he doesn't have to write back. It's okay.
So do you have some favorite letters in the book, maybe some things that you'd like to read?
Sure. There's one letter by a writer named Robin Hemley. He sort of speculates aloud about what he thinks Salinger's been doing all of these years, and a little bit he tries to guess why he sort of became a recluse. And I'll read part of this letter. Dear Mr. Salinger, I hear you've been writing away all these years, that after you die, we're going to be deluged with J.D. Salinger manuscripts, that they're in some vault or something. I used to imagine manuscripts stacked up to the ceiling, you counting your pages like some miser counting loose change. What else do you have to do with your day? But what good is it keeping your stories to yourself? I used to think they probably couldn't be any good because you must be so out of touch with the rest of the world. But maybe you're not. I think you watch a lot of TV. So do I. I bet you bought one of those George Foreman grills off the TV, didn't you? So did I. You see, we have that in common. I feel such a connection. And then later he says, or whoa, I didn't even think about this. Maybe you actually don't like anything you've written. Maybe it's just self-doubt that's made you so reclusive. Maybe it's one of those self-loathing issues, and that's why you don't want to have anything to do with the rest of us, because you loathe us all the more for loving you. Is that it? I hope not. But if you ever want to talk about it, you know where to reach me.
You know, what's interesting about that letter, and I think that rings true for a lot of people, is they both admire him, but there's also a certain anger toward J.D. Salinger. You know, you gave us this incredible gift, so why did you disappear? You know, you owe us something else.
That's right. That's actually a really interesting theme that carries through the book a lot, is sort of this, it's like the cult of celebrity, and what do we expect of our writers, and what do we expect of celebrities? For instance, you know, Harper Lee only ever wrote one book. She wrote The Kill a Mockingbird, and I think she's still alive, correct me if I'm wrong. And she never wrote anything else. And people have always said, well, you know, what happens to Scout after The Kill a Mockingbird? Or when are you going to write your next book? And she's always just kind of been like, well, I only had one book in me. And, you know, I'm not shy about saying it. And that's all I want to do. And we've sort of left her alone. I guess she's sort of been consistent over the years. And then there's another, you know, like Stephen King has just recently said that he's thinking about capping his pen, so to speak. He was writing a book and he just finished a book about a haunted car. And he's like, yeah, I think I already wrote a book about a haunted car. I'm recycling my ideas now, so I think I'm going to like try to exit while I'm on top. And while I'm sure there's some diehard fans who are like, no, you know, you can't stop. You still owe us more books. I think most people have like would say, you know, Stephen, you wrote a lot of stuff,
right,
and
yeah.
Now it's okay.
Right.
But Salinger, my theory is that he's had a really inconsistent behavior over the years. Like he published Catcher in the Rye, and then he sort of went away, and then he published a few more stories. And then he went into reclusion, and he shunned the public, and then he came out with another book, and then people would show up and say, are you writing? And he would say, yes, of course I'm writing, and you know, and then they'd ask him if he's going to publish, and he'd be like, well, I don't know, I'm going to, maybe, you know, I write for myself, and we'll see. And you know, just recently, like 5 or 6 years ago, it came out that he was planning on reprinting one of his short stories in book form. It was like the first publication in 30 years, and we're still waiting.
Is there one more letter you could read for us?
Sure. Dear J.D. Salinger, I made you a character in my 1982 novel Shoeless Joe because over the years you have made yourself conspicuous by hiding, claiming not to want publicity, but raising hell every time someone mentions your name in the media. I also knew you had worked your way through college as an actor on a cruise ship. Therefore, you know how to hold an audience and have done so many years without any new publications. Reading your collected and uncollected stories, I found you had used two characters named Kinsella, Ray in A Young Girl in 1941 with No Waste at All, published in Mademoiselle, and Richard in The Catcher in the Rye. Those were the connections I needed to draw you into my world of otherworldly baseball. Kinsella is an uncommon name, so I would name my character Ray Kinsella and have him turn up on your doorstep saying, I'm one of your fictional characters come to life. Years later, I received a letter from a Kinsella in Massachusetts, who had been your college roommate, so one small mystery was solved. When my book appeared, my publisher's lawyers received a grumbling letter from your attorneys saying that you were outraged and offended to be portrayed as a character in my book, and that you would be very unhappy if the work were transferred to other media. Hollywood didn't have the balls to use you as a character in the movie Field of Dreams, opting instead for a generic, black, reclusive author that you couldn't claim was a thinly disguised you. My publisher's lawyer said to me, "Look, all he can sue us for is about the sixth definition of libel, called false light," in which case he would have to go to court and say, "I've been portrayed in this book as a kindly, loving, humorous individual, while in reality I'm a surly so-and-so who occasionally shoots at tourists when they drive by my house. Therefore, I've been portrayed in a false light. I'm not sorry that I did what I did, and I hope that over the years you've come to enjoy my wise and warm portrayal of you. Go the distance, Bill Kinsella."
Chris Kubica, reading an excerpt from the book Letters to J.D. Salinger. Kubica and Will Hochman edited the book. That's the band Green Day with a song Who Wrote Holden Caulfield? John Wenke teaches at Salisbury University in Maryland, and he says Catcher has influenced American culture for years, from the new Salinger-esque movie Igby Goes Down to the murder of John Lennon. And Salinger's famous character, Holden Caulfield, still grabs readers today.
Well, what's dated, I think, is his haircut, maybe the cars that he looks at, and maybe a couple of the movies, but the problems that he has are not dated. And I think this is really at the point at which pop culture turns into literature, and it's a point at which he is concerned about universal problems of identity, of relating to authority. Holden is a very divided person, and I think those kinds of divisions not only catch adolescents, but catch people like me who are somewhat older than being adolescent, because he's really talking about the problem of how to connect with other people in a world that seems like it's betrayed everything. It's very interesting to me how Holden comes off as being a rebel, but at the same time, he is really in possession of the moral vision of the book. And this is a part of Salinger's greatness, I think, in that novel.
There are a couple of connections with The Catcher in the Rye that are interesting to follow up. Pretty sure I read that a couple of assassination attempts were made by men who said that they were obsessed with The Catcher in the Rye. Do you know that?
The most famous one is Mark David Chapman murdering John Lennon. He was picked up by the police after he sat down and was paging through The Catcher in the Rye. He shot Lennon, sat down, and waited for the police to come. And I think his explanation was that something to the effect that Holden Caulfield would have found that John Lennon had become a phony. But I think the roots of this kind of obsession have to do with the degree to which Holden himself becomes trapped into a kind of negativistic sense. In fact, at one point in the book, he's told by his sister, "You don't like anything that's happening." And so I think it's convenient for people who are angry or on the edge, who have a kind of reverse and demented messianic complex, to see in him a model.
Now, Mark David Chapman wasn't the only one, though I suppose the next one, the one who tried to assassinate President Reagan, may have been simply copying Chapman.
Well, I think that's part of it. And he also had an obsession with Jodie Foster laid on top of that. So that brings us into Holden's preoccupation with cinema and the power of movies to corrupt people. And one of the things that Holden hated about the movies was that they were phony. I don't know if this was working with Hinckley or not. Ronald Reagan, obviously, as an important movie star, becoming a politician.
Do you think that Salinger, because there's so little of Salinger published, I suppose in a way we're saying, do you think that The Catcher in the Rye has influenced the world of film?
Well, I think it certainly has, partly because Salinger is telling a story that is, I think, universal, and he draws upon a number of universal modes, you know, the adolescent initiation narrative, the quest story, the urban underground world narrative, which, you know, there are a lot of books out there. But I think two or three movies I could lay my hand on that actually contend with Salinger. To me, the most successful transformation of Salinger's mode onto film, I don't know if it was intentional, but Martin Scorsese's After Hours, it's the protagonist is a bit older, but he gets lost in a a nighttime after-hours world in New York City that is very, very close. I think it echoes and offers analogs to The Catcher in the Rye.
What'll it be? I don't want anything. I just want to sit here. Is that okay?
Sure.
Thanks.
But I'll tell you one thing. If you're looking to make friends, don't get your hopes up. It's like a pretty slow night.
Yeah. Well, it is late.
Not for this place. Things usually hopping around now.
That's all right, really. I really just want to get in out of the rain. I just hope it lets up soon. I really just want to go home.
There's Finding Forrester, which is an interesting...
Yeah, that one's almost a biographical statement about Salinger. Clearly, the Sean Connery figure could be a Salinger.
Yeah, it's a projected image of what Salinger might be if you could get to him. Salinger was very interested when he would interact with people, with working with the younger students, teenagers, gifted writers. And I think the producers and the writer of Finding Forrester were working from that particular model.
I need some help with this thing they got us doing at school.
Yes, this thing at school. And what thing are we talking about now?
You ever read that? I'm trying, man. I just can't seem to get past the first 10 pages, though.
As I recall, quite a while to get past those pages myself. Oh, Christ, you've dog-eared one of them. Show a little respect for the author, huh?
That's you, isn't it? You're the author.
There's also a kind of sentimentalizing of the relationship that I think Holden would find a bit phony.
Yeah, Holden might find it that way, but it does, for the viewer, give you some sense of what Salinger might have been for us all if he'd been willing to stay in touch.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think it's sad because Salinger had and probably has a great gift, and the great gift is his ability to change people's lives, to have written narrative. It's not only in The Catcher in the Rye, but some of his short stories and... at least Franny, of the Franny and Zoe, had great power. Books become part of people's lives and have everything to do with shaping consciousness. And I think this is the lesson in Finding Forrester, that the Sean Connery character was able to change a life and to help a life. And I think it was a good movie and a nice portrait of that particular possibility.
Do you think that Salinger has any competition, or is he still the reigning champion of adolescent angst?
Well, I think there was some competition that faded. Bret Easton Ellis, he made a bid to move in that direction, but I don't think he was able to sustain the promise of his early work, and I think part of it was kind of energy of imitation. So I can't think of another great voice like Holden Caulfield's at all. I don't think, I think Salinger is sort of a not an end stop, but I think it's distinctive, and I can't really think of other voices off the top of my head that are that powerful.
John Wenke teaches at Salisbury University, and he's the author of J.D. Salinger, A Study of the Short Fiction. Coming up, Garrison Keillor remembers those awkward teenage years. From a safe distance.
I'm not sure I could have looked back at them with pleasure when I was even in my 20s or 30s. The memory was still too painful.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Holden Caulfield might be the acme of teen angst, but the sentiment is alive and well in the work of Charles Baxter. Here he is with an excerpt from his novel, Saul and Patsy.
A squirrel squatted in the birdbath. Another squirrel was hanging by its claws onto the bird feeder. The girl, looking out her bedroom window at the backyard, cleaned her fingernails half-heartedly with a nail file and thought of the end of the world. She wondered why, if there was a word, ruthless, that was often applied to enemies of the USA, then what happened to its opposite, its lost positive, Ruth, which would have to mean kindness, but didn't mean anything, because no one used it. We had ruthless enemies, but no Ruth friends. Early in the morning, just after the sun was up, the squirrels looked like boys, somehow, she couldn't say why. Maybe because of the way they moved, skittering and chasing each other, twitching. Or maybe it was the fur, something. Her name was Gina, she was 16 years old, and it was Sunday, family day. After staring at the squirrels, she remembered to feed her guinea pig his breakfast food pellets. Wilbur squeaked softly as she dropped the pellets down the cage bars into the red plastic tray. It didn't take much to make him happy. On the other side of the room was a picture of Switzerland her mom had put up years ago. The picture had a lake in it, which was ruthlessly blue. Gina felt funny when she looked at this picture, so she didn't look at it very often. She couldn't take it down because her mom had given it to her. Family Day. The plan was her dad would show up and take them, her brother, her mom, herself, to the beach. Gina threw on a t-shirt and a pair of jeans. She grabbed her flute and went into the basement to practice for the school marching band, of which she was a member. 10 minutes later, she heard the thud of the morning paper flung against the front screen door. Gina put her flute on top of her dad's workbench and went upstairs to read the headlines. The news consisted of Iraq, bombs, Cuba, jail, Ireland, more bombs. And then there was something about Gordy Himmelman. Gordy Himmelman? He had shot himself. To death. It was permanent. Why hadn't anyone called her about it? She had been in classes with Gordy Himmelman since kindergarten, but he was in a class by himself, and she hadn't seen much of him since he had dropped out. He muttered and swore and blew his nose on notebook paper, and he talked to himself in long strings of garble and never had any friends you could show in public. You could feel sorry for him, but he would never notice how sorry you felt, and he wouldn't care. Pity was lost on him. It was a total waste of time. In third grade, he had brought a penlight battery into school, and, standing next to the monkey bars, he had swallowed it during recess to attract attention to himself. The battery was only a double A, but even so, he had black and blue marks all over him most days. His breath smelled of dill pickles that had gone unfresh. He had bicycled to that teacher, Mr. Bernstein's house, where he had blown his brains out in the yard, in front of a tree, in the morning. A matinee suicide. On the front page of the paper was a picture of the tree. It was a color picture, and you could sort of see the blood if you looked closely. Gina felt something stirring inside her. She was kind of interested in death. Gordy was the first person she'd ever known who had entered it. He had gone from being Mr. Nothing to being Mr. Something else, a temporarily interesting person. She sat at the kitchen counter eating her strawberry Pop-Tart, wondering whether Gordy was lying on a bed surrounded by virgins, or eternal fire, or what. It was sort of cool, him doing that. Maybe the smartest thing he'd ever done. Adventuresome and courageous. If you didn't have a life, maybe you got one by being dead. Her dad was late. Finally, he showed up at 11:30, saying, "Ha-ha, I'm late." He and Gina's mom were divorced, but they were still friends, and her dad had never really committed himself to the divorce, in Gina's opinion. He was half-hearted about it, a romantic sad sack. They had cooked up this family day scheme 2 years ago. Every weekend, he'd come to pick up Gina and Bertie, her little brother, and their mom, and then they'd do bowling-type activities for the sake of togetherness and friendliness, which, of course, was a total fraud, since they weren't together or friendly at all. Usually Saturday was family day, but sometimes Sunday was. Today they were going to the beach. Wild excitement. In the car, Gina studied her father's face. Because it was her father's, she didn't know if he was handsome or plain. You couldn't always tell when they were your parents. Sometimes at a stoplight or when he saw a car pull in front of him, her dad's face changed out of its TV sitcom expression. Suddenly he grimaced, like someone had started to do surgery on him, right over his heart, without anesthetic. And then that expression vanished, like it had never been there. What was that about? His pain, his secret squirrel life, probably. Still, there was no point in talking to him about Gordy Himmelman. At the lake, they settled in on their beach towels. Gina went to the concession stand to get herself an ice cream cone, which she would buy with her own money. The kid who worked at the stand selling snack food and renting canoes was a boy she didn't recognize, about her age, maybe a year or two older, with short orange hair and an earring, and he stood behind the counter next to the candy bar display, staring with pain and boredom at the floor. When Gina appeared, the boy looked at her with relief, relief followed by recognition and sympathy, recognition and sympathy followed by a leer as he checked out her breasts, the leer followed by a friendly smirk. It all happened very fast. He was like other boys. They shifted gears so quickly you couldn't always follow them into those back roads and dense forests where they wanted to live with the other varmints and wolves. "Raspberry, please. Single scoop." She smiled at him, to tease him, to test out her power, to give him an anguished memory tonight when he was in bed and couldn't sleep, thinking of her in the density of his empty, stupid life. Walking back to the sand and holding her ice cream cone, she started to think about Gordy Himmelman. And when she did, the crummy lake and the public beach with the algae floating in it 100 feet offshore in front of her made her feel weird and dizzy, as if, what was the point? She kept walking and taking an occasional personal lick at the ice cream. There weren't too many other people on the sand, but most of the men were fat, and their wives or girlfriends were fat too, and already they had started to yell at each other, even though it was just barely lunchtime. She kept walking. It was something to do. Nobody here was beautiful. It all sucked. The lake gave her a funny feeling, just the fact that it was there. The sky was sky blue, and her mother had said it was a perfect day, but if this was a perfect day, if this was the best that God could manage with the available materials, then, well, no wonder Gordy Himmelman had shot himself, and no wonder her mother had put up that picture of Switzerland in her bedroom. Gina saw her whole life stretched out in front of her, just like that, the 52 deck of cards with Family Day printed on one side, like the picture of the lake in Switzerland that she could barely stand to glance at, vacuuming her up. Why couldn't anything ever be perfect? It just wasn't possible. This wasn't perfect. It was its opposite, fecked, a totally fecked day. Just to the side, off on another beach towel, someone's mom was yelling at and then slapping a little boy, slapping him, wham, 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 out in public and in front of everybody. And of course the kid was screaming now, screaming, 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 screaming. Everybody having their own version of Family Day. Gina carried the ice cream cone to the water's edge. Right there, she saw herself in the algaed water, walking upside down, holding a raspberry ice cream cone, and next to her own water image, another water image, the sun this time. Gina walked into the water out to where the algae dispersed, staring first at her diminishing reflection and then at the sun. It'd be interesting to get blind, she thought. People and seeing-eye dogs would take care of you and lead you through the rest of your life forever. You'd be on a leash. The dog would make all the big decisions. Then she noticed that when she walked into the water, her images were sucked into it. As the water got deeper, there was less of you above it, as if you had gone on an instant diet. Okay, now that her legs had disappeared, you didn't have to look at her legs, because they weren't there anymore. Well, they were underwater, but the water was so dirty she couldn't see them as well as she could see her reflection at the surface of her waist, her head, her chest, the ice cream cone. Walking into the water was a kind of solution, watching your girl image get all swallowed up until there was no image left, just the water. She held the ice cream cone above the water and then, after another lick, let it go as she went under. Under the surface, she held her breath as long as she could, and then she thought of Gordy Himmelman, and, sort of experimentally, she tried breathing in some water just to see what it was like, and she choked. She felt herself panicking and going up to the surface, but then she fought the panic when she imagined she saw somebody like Gordy Himmelman, though better looking, more like her dad, under the water with her, holding her hand and telling her it was better down here and all the problems were solved. So she tried to relax and breathe in a little more water. She registered little thunderbolts of panic, and then some peace, and then panic. Then it was all right, and family day was finally over. And because she wasn't a very good swimmer anyway, she began to sink to the bottom, though there were all those annoying voices. She would miss Wilbur, the guinea pig, but not much else. She drifted down and away. Her father and the lifeguard had seen the scoop of raspberry ice cream floating on the surface of the lake at the same time. They both rushed in, and Gina's dad reached her body first. He pulled her up, thrashed his way to the beach, where, without thinking, he gave his daughter a Heimlich maneuver. Water erupted out of her mouth. Gina's eyes opened, and her father laid her down on the sand, and she said, "Gordy?" But what she said was garbled by the water still coming out of her lungs into her mouth and out of her mouth into the sand. As she came around, her hair falling around her eyes, she seemed disarrayed somehow, but pleased by all the fuss. And then she smiled because she had seen her father's face smeary with love.
Writer Charles Baxter with an excerpt from his novel, Saul and Patsy.
Load up on guns, bring your friends, it's fun to lose, and to pretend she's overboard and self-assured. Oh no, I know a dirty word.
Tori Amos singing Nirvana's anthem of teen angst, Smells Like Teen Spirit. Coming up, Margaret Salinger tells us why her father was no catcher in the rye. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. As well-loved as The Catcher in the Rye is, it's easy to romanticize its author. But Margaret Salinger says life with her father was never easy. Margaret Salinger is the author of the memoir Dreamcatcher, and she told Anne Strainchamps, the Salinger family was isolated from the rest of the world.
Our nearest neighbors were 5 miles away, and the sort of ratio of heads of cattle to people was quite high. My father specifically looked for a place that was far from other people, and we were way, way up on a hill. And I talked to my mother in preparation for the book, and she said it was actually a very specific policy of my father's that she was not to have any of her old friends, any of her... They used to see a lot of people when they were dating. They'd see a lot of their New York friends. And it wasn't until she left him and went to New York when I was about, I don't know, 2 or 3. So, of course, I don't remember it. One of the bargaining chips, as it were, in coming back was that she be allowed to see a few friends. So there were a couple of people on the acceptable list, but very, very few.
What kind of childhood did that make for you?
There are two answers to that. I think one, as I experienced it growing up when you don't know anything else, and then another, as, you know, I have children of my own and I look back on it and I, you know, in a bit of horror, the first response I'd have as you know, from the point of view of growing up, I think I was, well, I know I was quite lonely a lot of the time. And, you know, my really happy moments were, you know, at sleepovers at friends' house, which was usually the only way I could visit because people lived so far away. And, I mean, there were things also that were very delightful about it. I mean, I spent probably, you know, the better part of my day out in the woods and fields. And, you know, I made, it sounds crazy, but, you know, I made friends with trees and little animals that I knew where they were and flowers that would come back each year. So in that sense, I think children do their best to make up what they need. But I think it was so lacking in what kids need that it... Sometimes it succeeded better than others.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine there were both terrible things about it and also a few wonderful things about it at all. And maybe that, you know, the chance to live a very intense, imaginative life maybe would have been one of the good things about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when my father was present, which had nothing to do with whether his wife or kids needed him there. You know, I'm not saying this to drive home, oh, what a bad person he is. Just that it's such a different orientation than most people, most parents anyway, that I know now. When he was around, he could be absolutely delightful and, you know, full of stories and, you know, we'd take wonderful walks in the woods and things and, you know, he'd make up stories throughout the day that accompanied us on our walks and a whole panoply of imaginary characters. And when you're a kid, having a dad who also plays with imaginary friends can be pretty neat. What's not neat is when you actually need some grown-ups around, like when your mother's losing her mind. And I felt from a very, very early age, probably around 5 when my brother was born, I remember even articulating this to myself, you know, thinking, I am the only grown-up in this house. Particularly when the baby would cry and would need something, and everyone thought, oh, it's so cute. You know, she's the only one who knows what's, you know, she can speak baby language. And I'm thinking, you people are crazy. The baby's hungry. I can't reach the shelf to get the formula, you know. That was when I realized something was very wrong with them that wasn't wrong with me.
So there was that level of neglect, a baby that would cry and wouldn't be fed, a diaper that wouldn't be changed, I mean, meals for you that wouldn't happen?
Oh, for days. Absolutely. I mean, my mother would go into psychotic breaks and depressions, and my father wouldn't be in the house for 3 days at a time.
Where would he be?
Down in his little cabin working, or sometimes when he was stuck on something, he would go away to a hotel in Atlantic City or in Montreal or someplace on the train. All I knew is he went off on the train and would send postcards and as often as not come back with a manuscript ripped up rather than finished, but he was very often not there for stretches at a time.
It's so interesting because, you know, your father's known for writing so sensitively and accurately about adolescence, and sounds like he just could not tolerate having one of his own.
Well, he can't tolerate having someone who strays, having anyone around him who strays too far from his fantasy construct of who that person is, from the kind of authorial control that someone has over their characters. And I've seen him through the years, one by one, all his best friends would commit some, you know, unforgivable sin. And I mean, I'm not talking about murder, adultery, you know, the thou shalt nots, but something that just did not jibe with his, it's hard to explain, but his image of them as one of his characters. And they were banished. You're absolutely banished from your from his world if
your reality violates his illusion.
Yes. Yes.
Do you have a relationship with your father now?
I don't, and I knew that would happen.
Because of the book?
Yes. But it was really giving up a wish rather than a reality. I mean, when I had my son, I lived 2 hours away from him. Never came down, never showed any interest. And I basically had to kind of, you know, then this is when we were getting along wonderfully. You know, I basically had to take my son up and say, okay, this is enough. And I phoned his wife and said, we're coming. And she said, oh, well, let me check with him and make sure that's all right. I said, no, you're not hearing me. We are coming. You know, my son gets to meet his grandfather. The end. And it was a perfectly delightful visit. He was absolutely charmed by him, and who wouldn't be? And it was, you know, lovely and friendly and how, you know, terrific my son is. And then that's that.
And that was the last time Margaret Salinger spoke to her father. Her memoir is called Dreamcatcher. Today, Margaret Salinger is a chaplain living in New York City. Anne Strainchamp spoke with her. Coming-of-age stories like The Catcher in the Rye are universal, and everyone is different. Garrison Keillor tells his version in the novel Lake Wobegon, Summer 1956. It's an autobiographical look at Keillor's teenage years, based on the fictional town Keillor created for his radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. He read Steve Paulson an excerpt from the book.
I was a very good boy right up until the age of 11. Everybody said so. I stayed out of people's way and didn't ask too many questions. I sat up straight at meals, and when visiting other people's homes, I said, thank you for the lemonade, and please may I use your bathroom. I never picked my nose except behind closed doors, and when grown-ups spoke, I was attentive. I was often pointed out to other children as an example. Why can't you behave like Gary? Look at him. He doesn't wiggle around like a trapped squirrel during prayer meeting. He sits up straight, listens, and get something out of it. And then one day, in 1953, I said out loud, oh, to hell with it, in connection with a sack of garbage Daddy told me to take to the garbage can. I was standing on one side of the screen door and he on the other. I was wearing khaki trousers and an old Boy Scout shirt of my older brother's. I was surprised to hear these words myself. They just sprang out like a sneeze, oh, to hell with it, and a great darkness fell over the earth. Daddy was on the verge of apoplexy. He thought I had said, go to hell, to him. He marched into the kitchen and thundered around for a while, and then Mother came out to speak to me. You upset your father terribly when you act that way. Do you realize that? And do you know how sad it makes God to hear you say such a thing? The Creator, the hanger of the stars and planets, the unseen listener, he himself mourned for my saying the terrible word.
Now, I would think that a lot of people would think back to the time when they were 14 as one of the worst years of their life. It's certainly one of the more confusing times in life. But you obviously have a lot of affection for those early teenage years. Did you enjoy them yourself?
I enjoy looking back at them at this great distance. I'm not sure I could have looked back at them with pleasure when I was even in my 20s or 30s. The memory was still too painful.
So as you were creating your character, Gary, did you find yourself reliving what it was like for you when you were 14?
I relived some parts of it, but at this great remove, most of the misery and the pain has pretty well leached away. And it becomes comedy, of course.
Now, there's so much that you conjure up, the family pressures of growing up in a religious family. There's Gary's slightly naughty rebellion, but it's all so innocent in that time and place, 1950s Minnesota. Was that a very different world than what we have now?
It was quite a different world for young people. This was an era when young people were not scheduled as they are now. The young people that I know today have social calendars and schedules of lessons and games and activities that are much more complicated than my own. Young people carry around cell phones and pagers. And in my day, young people just, they kind of wandered around and they hung out together like coyotes. They were wild and free. And they went off beyond the purview of their parents and lived independent lives.
Was that an important experience for you as you honed your talents as a writer to have that kind of freedom?
Well, it gave a person the freedom to write, you know, and to be able to sit and spend long periods of time with a piece of paper and making things up. Now, I think children do not do anything that their parents are not aware of. If I were writing like that today, I think that my parents would feel an obligation to encourage me and find a place for me to take lessons or, you know, take a writing course or read a book about writing, and they would be full of helpful suggestions. And it would no longer be my idea. You see, It would no longer be my rebellion. It would be something they were supervising, which is entirely different.
I'm curious why you decided to set a novel in the 1950s. Why this particular period of the century?
Because I wanted to write about myself when I was 14, and I was 14 in 1956. I wouldn't know how to make myself 14 at any other time, 1963 or 1975. I guess I wouldn't feel confident doing it. This is a thinly disguised memoir.
Did you go by the name Gary when you were 14?
That was my given name.
That Oh, really?
Is my Christian name.
So when did you become Garrison?
I became that in junior high school. I was writing poetry for the high school literary magazine. This was in a town where boys did not write poetry. I figured I needed a pen name, and I thought of that one. It was kind of seemed like a variation on my name, and also it had the connotation of strength and militance, and I liked that.
Now, does this whole story come from memory and imagination, or did you actually go back and read up on the 50s to refresh your sense of what that era was like?
I'm older than you, and so I remember all of these things. And what I don't remember, I can make up in a convincing manner. I've forgotten the lyrics to all of the songs that I loved back in the 50s, so I just made up new ones. That's one of the benefits of having wasted your life being a writer, is that at least you can do that much. So I was there. I saw, I heard, I remember some of it.
We've been talking a lot about what life is like for a 14-year-old boy, and I'm wondering if you have any favorite writers who you think are especially good at evoking this time in life.
I love J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye. I loved it as a kid, and I've looked at it again recently, and I still think it's a marvelous book. I'm glad that it is still being read by young people, and that so many young people reading it have the same feeling I had when I read it in high school. I just felt that he was a friend of mine and that he was talking directly to me.
Garrison Keillor is the host of the public radio program A Prairie Home Companion and the author of the novel Lake Wobegon, Summer 1956. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for J.D. Salinger and Beyond, number 113A. If you have questions or comments on the show, you can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us an email through our website at www.wpr.org/book.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Her novel Bel Canto was a hit, so novelist Ann Patchett is a star. But back when they were in college, it was her friend Lucy Greeley who got treated like a rock star. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, a look at uncommon friendships. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.